This week on The Veterinary Viewfinder, a very special guest, nominated for two Pulitzer Prizes, international best-selling author Stephen Kotler. You do not want to miss this episode. Welcome back to The Veterinary Viewfinder, the podcast that tackles the toughest topics in veterinary medicine. And this week, we are honored, thrilled, just amazed, overjoyed, whatever adjectives you want to describe this adverbial phrase that I'm trying to put together. We have got Stephen Kotler, who is not only a dear friend of mine, but he is a dear friend to animals everywhere. And he's going to be talking about his brand new best-selling book that you just absolutely have to read. And we'll talk about that in just a second. But he's also going to talk about his animal sanctuary that he and his wife, Joy Nicholson, have established in New Mexico, and just take us on a journey of what it's like to be nominated twice for a Pulitzer Prize. Before we get into all this Stephen stuff, as always, I am one of your hosts, Dr. Ernie Ward.
And I'm registered veterinary technician, Becky Mosser.
And Stephen Kotler, thanks for joining us today.
Ernie, it's so good to be with you. Becky, it's good to be with you. That's a very lovely introduction you gave me. I don't know if I can live up to that.
Again, nominated for two Pulitzers for his last book, Stealing Fire, which you guys know I've talked about on this podcast multiple times. It is a must read for anybody who wants to up their creativity and intellectual prowess. It's a fantastic book. He was also nominated for a Pulitzer way back in the day for a book that we're going to talk a lot about today, and that is A Small Furry Prayer, which really details and chronicles his life with Joy Nicholson and how they established Rancho de Chihuahua, which is amazing. They have these special hospice, special need care for these Chihuahuas. It's pretty cool. He's been featured in New York Times, The Atlantic, Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Wired, Time Magazine. You used to do a column for Psychology Today, Stephen. Remember that?
I do. Good memory.
Hey, and before we jump into that, one of the first things that I've known Stephen for, Stephen, I think it's 11 or 12 years now that we've kind of made a personal connection, but I knew you before that, and you wrote an article, I'm sorry, I just got to drag this up because it is in your latest book, but you talk about the five-year ban, right? That came from Psychology Today, and I remember that because you set off a firestorm. Just set it up for our audience what the five-year ban was, because it's pretty cool.
So I had been spending a long time. This was sort of after I wrote Small Furry Prayer, before I wrote Abundance with Peter Diamandis. And Abundance was a look at how do you use technology to solve grand global challenges. And one of the, you know, the challenge that was deepest to my heart was the loss of biodiversity, right? The sixth great extinction.
Right.
And that was what I was really trying to solve. And what was amazing was one, oh my God, there was all this technology that looked like it could actually be applied to the problem and really give us headway, but there were just too many people in the world, right? Too many people taking up too much land, needing too many resources. And my thinking was, if we could just have a grassroots, completely voluntary moratorium on childbirth for 5 years, and those people who really wanted to have kids during that period could adopt, preferably from foreign countries where situations were dire. It's a million less people. It's a billion less people on the planet. It's a billion less people with a B. And it gives our technology a chance to catch up to our problem is really what it does. And it gives the Earth a little bit of breathing space at a time it sorely could use it. And if you're adopting out of a kind of war-torn nations kind of thing, you're taking children who's, you know, when they're growing up, if you look at the statistics, terrorism, drug dealing, et cetera, it doesn't go well as a general rule. So you could solve a whole bunch of problems at once was the thinking. And I was very, very passionate when I wrote the particular article. I was, as you pointed out, like I wrote the article and took my wife and we drove to the airport. We got on a plane, went to visit my parents in Florida. And like 2 days later,
Holy smokes.
Got online and went, oh crap. I guess people don't like the idea of talking about population out loud, especially for animal rights purposes, right?
That
struck you know, animal rights is itself not the greatest topic, as you know, not super friendly to a lot of people. You couple that with, hey, stop having kids for a while and all hell rains down.
Right. And the reason I mentioned that, Stephen, obviously that's just a wild tangent, but, you know, there's a lot of your story baked into that, you know, because here's a guy who has dedicated his life, quite frankly, to writing about big problems with bigger solutions. This guy has done everything in his power to teach the world, and I say that truly, Stephen, how to tap into better creativity, how to be more focused. I mean, gosh, you know, look, I popped my L-theanine this morning, right, with you in mind, you know. So there are all these little things that Stephen has worked really hard to get these messages out, and one of them is solving, you know, gosh, how do we make sure we have enough water and oil and all these types of things. So it's quite a remarkable guy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so excited to have you here and to have this conversation, because obviously, this is important to the veterinary community in a very special way, in my opinion, because I think our science brains forget to be creative. I think we don't tap into that part of ourselves. And I think some of what you're talking about is like so overwhelming that people sometimes are paralyzed with the magnitude of what it would really look like to make these kinds of changes in their lives. But you break it down and make it simple and make it manageable. And how do you find ways to help people make those first steps? Because I think that can be the hardest part, even when you're feeling incredibly inspired.
So I'm going to back you up and I'm going to contradict you, because I have spent a lot of time in and around the vet community. And, you know, I live with a phenomenal, phenomenal diagnostician. And I see how much creativity goes into just that work. And I see how much so I think there's a lot more creativity going into your business than you're actually giving yourselves credit for. I think creative decision-making and problem-solving is very much at the core of animal work, because you're dealing with creatures who you can't say, hey, how does this feel? What do you think? Does that hurt?
Right. Right.
So there's a lot. So I think there's a lot more creativity involved in the community. So I mean, my first answer is, and I mean this really seriously. I often think with high performance, strengths are really important in high performance, and figuring out what you're great at and leveraging your strengths are really critical. And I think vets, anybody who works with animals, especially on the medical side, is a fantastic creative problem solver by definition. It comes with the territory. So I think that's a fundamental skill that people can start with and build on, rather than just ignore. I don't know if that really answered your question, but I feel strongly about that. I've noticed it over the years.
No, I think it's actually an important part, because it comes down to being more in tune. And you're exactly right, because it is a lack of being in tune that makes me forget how creative we are. I mean, I've seen veterinarians make wheelchairs for hedgehogs. I've seen, you know, you go into any zoo medicine environment and you see tons of creativity around you. But in my brain, it's interpreted as a science to get the job done. So I think you're right, backing it up, looking inside and finding, you know, that important part of yourself is a very important, great step. So I love it.
Yeah. And I think I also, it frustrates me because science to me is massively creative. In fact, you know, at the Flow Research Collective, which is, you know, where the organization that I founded, actually, excuse me, that looks at flow states, we do a lot of big data. We do a lot of AI kind of stuff. And I always point out to people that even though we've got machines everywhere in the chain, there's still always a human making a decision. Even when it comes to big data, even when you try to like remove, there's somebody is making a creative decision inside of it. So even if the science feels the most remote from creativity, it still leaks in and is usually influential.
Yeah, I love that. Well, one of the other themes that I've kind of picked up on, and we've had these discussions offline, you know, over the years, is that of empathy. And your latest book, Last Tango in Cyberspace, actually follows a main character who is this empath, and you call him an M tracker, which means he uses empathy to sort of determine if things are going a certain way. So empathy, though, I think if I trace back Stephen's history, at least as an adult, originates with animals. I mean, even going back to West of Jesus, you know, Stephen, which you chronicle your really struggle with Lyme disease and you find salvation through surfing. I'm sorry if I probably horribly summarized that, but that's sort of my take on it, you know, exploring like spirituality through, you know, I think experiential, you know, activities like surfing. And as you say, and the barrel, that's where you find salvation sometimes. But the reality is empathy is a big part of being a veterinarian. What do you think, I mean, what are some of the lessons that you would like to share with vets about the power of empathy and how to maybe enhance their own empathic relations with animals?
Yeah, so I you're absolutely right. And I think, so if there's a point to Last Tango in Cyberspace, I mean, this is a thriller about future technology. But it's got a moral, and if there's any moral, the moral is empathy for all.
Right.
And what I mean by empathy for all is empathy for plants, animals, ecosystems, and all humans. And the reason is, and this is kind of both the answer to your question, and then we can start talking about empathy in a second. But so eco-psychology, which is the study of how the mind interacts with the natural world, as you know, there's 50 years of data that says, hey, the brain is bombarded by information on a daily basis, on a moment-by-moment basis. In fact, the current numbers people put on it is that we take in 400 billion bits of information a second.
Wow.
Consciousness, what we can pay attention to, what we're aware of, is 2,000 outputs. So the vast majority of everything is filtered out subconsciously, right? And
right.
So what does the filtering is the question you want to ask. And a lot of it is safety and security stuff. And the other stuff is our goals. And what the eco-psychology shows is that, look, man, if you live in boxes and you stare at screens all day, your brain filters out what's unimportant. It filters out plants, animals, and ecosystems because they're not in your face for survival. You're in a box staring at another box.
Right.
And so the reason a lot of people think we're in the midst of a giant environmental catastrophe at a global level is because we literally cannot perceive the very thing we're trying to save. Why does empathy matter? Empathy is literally the secret weapon. When we learn how to be empathetic, right, we're turning essentially curiosity into emotion, in a sense, into common ground in that process. And what it does is it forces the brain to be perceptive, to take in data. And the story I always like to tell is a story, a very personal story. It's in Small Furry Prayer, but when Joy and I opened Rancho de Chihuahua and we went from having 8 rescue dogs to having 40
right.
very, very quickly, we took in, we ended up with a number of very feral dogs, and we work with extreme special needs and hospice cases. So like our dogs are, you know, I always say, like, if you've been tied to a radiator and beaten for a decade, have 1 eye, 3 legs, no tail, you're our guy. Right? Like, that's who we work with. And that's who we want. But like, these dogs are terrified, and they're terrified of men because mostly it's men who are doing the damage. So we had feral dogs who were terrified of men, and I would get up in the middle of the night to go take a piss, and I would get bit. They yep. would attack me, right? And sure, this is cute 1 day or 2 days or 3 days, but when it is literally every single day and you're just trying to get through the night so you can get up in the morning to make a goddamn living and pay for the 40 dogs, right? Like, come on, can I get a break here? And I would start, and after like a year of it, about 8 months, this one dog, Misha, I had just like, I was losing it. And he was starting to attack me on site every time he saw me. I'd leave my office and he would run across our fields and it'd leap at me. And I'm screaming at him and Joy is losing her mind with me because she's like, you're screaming at the dog and like he's a rescue dog and the worst thing, right? This is going on and on and on. Like I'm about to get divorced, right, over all this. And I'm an asshole, clearly, because, you know, I can't do my job. And I was like, all right, I got to reboot. And I had already, like, I was towing the line that I thought animals really were equal to humans. I was saying it to myself, like, God, I really feel like animal, you know, dogs, when I think about it, you know, I do the math the way a lot of people do the math around consciousness. I'm like, well, they've got the same basic 6 emotions as I do. They have all of my social emotions. So they've got the next 6 that stack on top of this. In fact, some of those social emotions are better developed than mine. And the average dog has the intelligence of like a 3 to 4 year old,
right?
So you're essentially killing small children by killing dogs. And I'm running around saying I'm equal to them, but I'm not really acting that way. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to start treating Misha as if he was my brother, Brad, having a nutty. Every time Misha tries to attack me, I'm going to pretend it's Brad and he's going through a divorce or he found out his son has cancer or something like that. And that's why he's going crazy. And in doing that, it only took a couple of weeks at that level of active empathy, like I'm actively trying to treat you as if you were literally not just another sentient being, but my family in a time of crisis. And what happened to me is suddenly 2 weeks later, I'm noticing all kinds of stuff in Misha's behavior that I never noticed before. And I don't even have to like be worried about it anymore, because now I'm seeing what's causing the problem, what I'm doing to scare him, how my body movements are. You know, like suddenly I'm like a ninja. I can walk around and not get bit. Right. And it was empathy that got me there. It was empathy. I became empathetic. My brain started saying, oh, you're trying to feel what this is feeling. Here, have some more perception. I got the perception. The perception was what I was missing. Suddenly I could solve the problem. Suddenly I was like, oh my God, not only is this an amazing, you know, thing that I'm feeling, but I'm getting information. So I had the exact experience that eco-psychologists talk about at a time that like I needed it to save my life, my marriage, my rescue, my visions of the future. Like everything was in jeopardy because, you know, I was exasperated after a year of this, and it really worked. So some of that is, you know, that's at the heart of the empathy obsession.
Yeah. And again, you know, I've said this multiple times on this podcast and elsewhere. If you have not read A Small Furry Prayer, just go do it. Just go buy it today, download it, whatever. It's just amazing. It will give you so much insight into animal behavior, the struggles that we all share when we try to take on too much responsibility, aka Becky. But more importantly, more importantly, it starts to push this message of empathy. But Stephen, there's something else that's buried in what you just said that you've also really done a great job of illuminating for the world. And that is one of intention and focus, because you started saying something there that really, I think, drives home the message of when I started actively doing this, thinking this, you know, being intentional with my thoughts and actions. That's really what the flow state, that helps us get there. That, to me, that's what you've brought so much value to my life.
I think it rolls back even slightly. You're totally correct. I think so the very first psychology textbook ever written was written by William James, Harvard psychologist, yep, philosopher, right?
Yep.
Genius. And the textbook has two main points. So like a lot of people don't know this, but high performance as a field was sort of founded in a weird way by Nietzsche. He's often considered the first high performance philosopher. Nietzsche basically said, hey, we can become the Ubermensch, right? We have Superman within us, but it's not for everybody. Maybe 10% of people can actually do this. And William James came along and said, no, I think you're wrong. I think everybody can do this, but the secrets are habit and attention.
Right.
And habits and attention are the two biggest levers we have. Flow is gigantic, but you can't get to flow until you've kind of mastered habits and attention.
Right.
Because they're just the two biggest weapons we have. So that to me is where kind of high performance starts. And flow, we know there are flow states have triggers, preconditions that lead to more flow. And flow only shows up when all our attention is in the right here, right now. So that's what all the triggers do. They drive the attention into the present moment, right? If I were to say it more technically, since we've got scientists on the back end of this, I would say they do flow triggers do one of three things. They either drive norepinephrine or dopamine into the system, which are the two main,
yep,
two main focusing neurochemicals in the brain, or they lower cognitive load, right? All the crap trying to pay attention to at once. So, and which gives us more energy to pay attention to the present with. So that's what all the triggers do, but you start with attention, right? Like when I work with organizations at the Flow Research Collective, the first thing, I can swear on your podcast, correct?
Yeah, of course.
All right. So the first thing I do when I walk into an organization is say, look, if you can't hang a sign on your door that says, fuck off, I'm flowing, you can't do this work. Where there's nothing to talk about. I can go home now.
Right.
Like,
right.
Flow demands 90 to 120 minute periods of uninterrupted concentration, or as close to that as we can get.
Right.
That's what the research shows. So attention is the first lever you can get, and uninterrupted concentration, you know, cell phones are off, instant messages, Facebook, right, all that stuff. That's the habit part of it, right? That's got to be the ironclad habit. For myself, I like to write first thing in the morning. 4 to 8 a.m. is when I write. So the night before, I shut everything off. Email goes off. My phone gets unplugged. My cell phone gets turned off. All the messaging gets turned off. Everything's gone. I don't even have a light in my office. So when I walk down here, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. It's pitch black. All I have is the words on the computer screen.
Yep. Got to block it all out. And I love this. So coming back to Rancho de Chihuahua, for people that aren't familiar with this, and again, I encourage you to go and look online, but sort of set the stage, like what is the current iteration of Rancho de Chihuahua and what are your objectives?
So I feel a little, this is a strange conversation because we are literally, after 11 years, we are moving
right,
and we are right. So we're blowing it up and changing our mission and moving in a bunch of different directions. But what the mission was simple. We wanted to do all the stuff nobody wants to do. So we wanted to work in an extremely low-income community with high instances of animal cruelty so we could put ourselves on the front line. Nobody wants to do hospice care because the dogs die and it's expensive. Nobody wants to do special needs care because you end up with too many lifers. So you can work with dogs for 2 years and they're never adopted. And so you're stuck with a crazy feral dog oftentimes for forever. Right. And that's, you know, expensive and it limits your ability to do other work in the world and et cetera, et cetera. So nobody wants, so we just wanted to do all of it at once. So right. That's been the mission for the past 11 years. And I think we've done some good work. I think we've helped 500 or 600 dogs at our facilities themselves, and I think another 5,000 or 6,000 through our outreach programs. But the flip side is, we've done nothing, right? They euthanize 20 million dogs a year. I mean, we save 500. Are you kidding? So one of the things we're morphing into is something that has kind of maybe a bigger national footprint and can really go after, to me, what is the first issue, which is spay and neuter laws. I think if there's two things that I'd want to change in the pet world, it's spay and neuter laws and, I don't know, cultured meat into pet food. But wait, I think somebody's doing that already.
Yeah, there might be somebody help. Yeah. So one thing too, just to kind of lean into how heavily you are in this community. I mean, you know, you and Joy have been doing this back to LA times, right? I mean, when you guys
I mean, I guess we were doing it a little bit together because we were living together, but she had been running. Well, she made a lot of money off her first novel, which was called Tribes of Palos Verdes. And she took
an amazing book. Amazing about book. A young girl, finds her way through surfing, finds some bad stuff and some good stuff, but,
A movie came out last year starring Jennifer Gardner.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bleak book and it's a bleak movie, but
of course.
Have at it. And she took all that money and she actually opened her first operation in Mexico. So she was doing dog sanctuary work in Mexico, which you want to talk about pushing a rock uphill. And that, as you might not be surprised, went horribly wrong. And she came back to LA and started again with one dog at a time, which was what she was doing, what I helped out a little bit with when I moved in with her, or maybe I tried to not get in the way of. And then we came here to do Rancho de Chihuahua together. And it was small dogs also because, you know these stats, but small dogs, Chihuahuas are the second most euthanized dog in America, they get the least amount of funding. Out of any other dog, because, you know, a lot of people don't actually think small dogs are cute. I don't know what's wrong with them, but okay, whatever. You people are sick and you should go the way of the 5-year ban. I'm sorry. What were you talking about already?
I'm very interested in this. I have a million questions about the rescue itself, but one thing that I feel like could be really relatable to our listeners is the boundaries that you've set up with Chihuahuas. I have to assume that there are tons of people who call you saying, either this very clearly not a Chihuahua is a Chihuahua, can you help? Or, oh, but just could you take just one? How did you set up the boundaries? How do you keep yourself from saying yes to everything?
You're talking about the reason we are stopping doing what we're doing, in all honesty.
Yeah.
Because I wrote Small Furry Prayer. And I mean, I wrote Small Furry Prayer at a time that, like, I was very poor when we started this rescue. And I was very poor when I wrote that book. And we were desperate for funding, desperate for anything. We'd been doing this for 2-3 years. We couldn't get a volunteer to come show up and help. We couldn't get anything. And I rate Small Furry Prayer. It's nominated for a Pulitzer. It's a bestseller. And we think, oh my God, everything's going to change. We'll finally get some help. And what ended up happening was our, can you take our dog phone calls and emails and texts went from 20 a day to 500-600 a day.
Oh my God.
I mean, and we are the last stop on a long train of misery, right? When we say no, it's a euthanasia. 99% of the time, if we say no, it's a euthanasia.
Yep.
And so Joy and I start this rescue because all we want to do is save dogs. And actually all we ended up doing for years was sentencing dogs to death, because when you're doing hospice care, right, your metric is how long can you keep this animal alive? And our maximum capacity, truthfully, with no help and just Joy and me, if I'm not writing books and I'm working full time, is probably 27 dogs. And we, by the way, we ended up with 40 because two of the dogs, one of the dogs we ended up with, turned out to be pregnant and had 8 puppies.
Wow. Oh my gosh. And Dr. Ernie accuses me of taking on my hand.
This is the conundrum though, Stephen. How do you say no?
Right.
We are, you know, I mean, we're exhausted from no.
Yeah.
And I'm sure everybody in this world is exhausted from no. And it was the craziest thing in the world. We're like dying. We're like, can we get a freaking plumber to help us with a leak? Because we're in the middle of nowhere and we can't get any help here. And people are sending us dog jewelry in the mail, boxes of dog jewelry.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I'm just like, are you kidding? Like, right. We can't feed our animals or pay our vet bills. And thank you for your 17th box of dog jewelry. Like, are you like, right. What is that? Right. So, and I'm not saying, like, people mean very well, and they're not actually thinking about what's on the other end of this actual situation. And it's difficult. And I don't think the rescuers get the support they need from the very community that is supposed to support them, the people who are actually doing the frontline work. And after, you know, 10 years, I mean, Rancho de Chihuahua, we're going to start doing seniors. We're going to bring senior dogs into senior living facilities and do seniors for seniors. And we're going to try to do some of that work with autistic children. And we're going to do small level rescue work. And I think Joy's going to go back to working in a vet office because it, I mean, we may do other stuff at a bigger level in the years to come, but I think that's where we're going for the next little bit, because after 11 years, it's, you can't draw those lines, Becky, as far as I can tell, because they're not like, we had to hide our phone number. We had to hide our email. I had to get somebody else to answer Facebook messages because they were so mean and awful. It was insane. It's insane. Like, I don't know what the answer to that one is. Like, because you can draw every line you want, but the community doesn't understand the work, so they're not supportive.
Right.
Yeah. And we've done a podcast on how difficult it can be. So I know it can be so frustrating. And it sounds like you guys have really pushed through a lot of things, but it sounds like you have to, you know, you have to put the boundaries up for self-care. And it sounds like what you're doing to continue to have even a toe in what you love, but to not get completely burnt out and leave. And it's very parallel to what we experience in the veterinary industry, I think.
I think that's probably true.
And just to tie it back to empathy, Stephen, this is where empathy goes horribly wrong for many of us, right? Because we are extending so much of that emotional self to others to intuit and to be intentional. And then it kind of blows up in our face a little bit, metaphorically speaking.
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, I think that's the danger, right? Because if you're doing this work, if you're a vet, if you're a rescuer, if you're doing any of this work, you love animals, massive amounts of empathy for animals, right? And that's enormous energetically. And what you want in return is just a little more empathy from other people. But the empathy for animals is getting in the way of the empathy for other people. And it's a no-win situation, which is why I think I want to back off and go after spay and neuter laws at a national level,
right,
with, you know, all the force I can muster. Because that, at least, I think, you know, that pet zoning, changing zoning laws in cities so people can have more animals, so rescuers can do more work legally, and using technology to solve those problems, indoor pet bathrooms. We've talked about this, things that you could actually do.
And I'll pitch something that Steve and I have talked about for over a decade. And that is, you know, what our challenge, and, you know, Steven, we really need to, when we ever get some time, pick this ball back up. But basically, we were having these discussions years ago that go like this. Okay, if we're going to urbanize our planet, which we are, and we're going to have to, so how can we now make cities, and more importantly, dwellings that support animal companionship? Because currently, right now, if you live in New York City, where do you take your dog for a walk? I mean, you find a sidewalk, you find a park. I mean, but still, that also adds all types of environmental contamination, pollutants, and so forth. It's not an efficient solution. And so Stephen, you know, was like, well, look, what about reclaiming waste? Like, should we not be able to have a way where the pet urinates, defecates indoors, and then that waste is reclaimed for energy, for example? Like, where are those future buildings and those designs? So Stephen, it's something that, you know.
Yeah, that's the cohabitation project.
And we need to revisit that at some point.
What I've always wanted to do, and this is what I've always said, is I want to take that project, use the, you know, build buildings built for human and animals together, use whatever profits come out of that to fund lobbyists to go at spay and neuter laws.
Yeah.
That's what, that, like, that to me is the biggest dent you can make. And that's sort of where I'd like to go next. I just don't want to run that company alone.
Well, and we're all busy, but yes, it's, So if you're listening out there today and you want to know more, definitely hit me up and I'll be glad to clue you in. But the other part of this discussion is, you know, I think people like us, like Becky, who've been doing this for decades or more, you know, we do realize at some point, wow, this has got to change, you know, at the foundational level of our society, which is the laws. Because, you know, we can all like do our little bit and save 500 or 5,000 here, you know, maybe have impact over there. But until we actually roll this out on a big, broad level, it gets frustrating, Stephen. I mean, you're right.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's good frustration. Like, right. Yes, it's been, you know, it's frustrating on this, but like, okay, cool. It's a lot of energy. I can take that frustration and turn it into change in the world. So it's not, I'm not defeated at all. I'm frustrated because shit did not go the way I thought it was going to go.
Right.
You know,
right.
But you know, I learned a ton and I met a ton of people like you, and now I'm a little wiser, a little emphasis on little, and you know, and maybe can take that energy in someplace more potent, which I think is cool.
Yeah.
I've got no problem with it.
Well, as we kind of wrap up our conversation, and this could go on, and you guys can see why I'm so excited to share him with you. But, here's the thing I want to leave our listeners with today. We have outlined some pretty difficult and even terminal issues that our profession faces, whether it's empathy, whether it's overpopulation, whether it's overpopulation of humans. I mean, there's a lot of big problems. But yet, Stephen, you have remained positive. You know, I mean, you wrote a book, two books with Peter called Bold and Abundance that basically said, you know, dude, we got this. In fact, Tomorrowland, which is one of my other favorite books by you, you know, how do you remain?
Yeah, but let's tell people that you're a weirdo because you also like my first novel and nobody likes that book.
Dude, that got all kind of awards. That got me turned on to Stephen. But how do you stay positive?
It's an interesting question. And one of the things, this is really going to sound strange, negativity is bad for creativity.
Yeah.
It has foundational impacts on kind of how the brain processes and takes in information. So, and if you're interested in high performance, you have to maintain optimism. So that's and that's tricky to do. And there are a lot of different ways to do it. Right. One of the easiest and simplest is a gratitude practice. And I know that gets all kinds of like hokey, you know, oh, woo-woo stuff, and absolutely, but what a gratitude practice does is, because the brain has this great built-in bullshit detector, so you can't be fake optimistic. That's not, right? The brain goes, hey, you're lying. No, right? Like, no, in fact, you actually do work at Walmart, man. You're not going to be a millionaire if you stare at that vision board, right? The brain knows you're lying. But gratitude, you're actually saying thank you for stuff that has already happened, right? So it's actually real. Thank you, I'm alive today, right? Like, so what happens is the brain goes, oh, look, there's less reason to be scared. There's good stuff. I can start looking for good information. You start getting new information. It sort of works in the way empathy works. But I will tell you the actual answer to your question is, I decided around the time I had Lyme disease. I was sick. I was in bed for 3 years. And when I came out, you know, like a lot of people on the end of a long illness, you sort of redirect your life a little bit. And some of that was into animals, obviously.
Yeah.
But some of it was also, I'm a firm believer that I only care about those problems I am actively trying to solve.
Yeah.
And I know what my fights are. I've had the same, I'm going to fight for the environment. I'm going to fight to advance flow science and research and human performance because I believe that the better we get, the more chance we have to tackle global problems, right? So like those, and I care about the drug war because I've seen so many people on all sides of it just have their lives ruined by it. There are a couple other things where I'm active on the front lines, writing about it, thinking about it, talking about it. And if it's not those problems, it's somebody else's problem, literally. Like, I can only do what I can do. And if I'm going to get into a problem, I'm going to get all the way in and I'm going to give it everything. I'm going to get into the fights that I care about and I can do something about.
Yeah. And don't let it affect you. I mean, that's the other part of this is those other fights, the things where you can't focus and have intention. Yeah. You can't let it creep into your life, as Stephen says, and then destroy you from within, because it will.
And I think equally important, and this is really key for people, I think, who work with animals and do all this, you know, do all this kind of pushing the rock uphill kind of work, is I'm really like, victory to me is I woke up, I had 10 items on my to-do list and I gave every one of them everything I had and I'm done. Like, you got to know when to declare victory. You got to know, like, you can only do your best. There are actually items on my to-do list every day, because I have learned over time that that is the maximum number of things I can do at my very best.
Yeah.
So that's what I do. And it's, I mean, on a certain level, I'm sticking my head in the sand on a lot of stuff, but it works for me. And I think I'm kind of effective.
You're tremendously effective. You've affected me and millions of others all around the world. It's really been just an honor and a pleasure and thrill once again to spend time with you, Stephen. I just can't thank you enough. His latest book is Last Tango in Cyberspace. Go read it. Then read A Small Furry Prayer, which is going to blow your mind and warm your heart in ways that you can't even imagine, especially if you're animal people like we all are. That one was nominated for Pulitzer as well. Stealing Fire will teach you how to expand your consciousness in ways that you didn't even know were possible. If you've ever struggled with a chronic disorder, whether it's depression or an illness like Lyme disease that Steve confronted, West of Jesus is just one of those books that sticks with you. That one, I find something new every time. That's a banger.
Ernie, you should tell the other half of that story, that you were actually stranded in a cabin in Montana in a blizzard, and it was the only book for 40 square miles. So I appreciate it. Thank you very much, but you really should tell the truth.
Not true at all. Listen, if you want to find out more, go to StephenKotler.com. Follow him. If you ever get the chance to see this guy in person speaking, just do it. Just make it happen somehow. Read his books. Share his knowledge. I mean, Becky, you can see why I wanted this to happen.
It was amazing. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here today. We would love to hear, you know, how you've been inspired by Stephen. Have you read his books? What are some favorite quotes? And how has that kind of helped enlighten you and bring change into your life? We want to hear from you. Don't forget to hit us up on social media. You can find us at Vet Viewfinder or on Facebook at Veterinary Viewfinder.
Until next time, remember, be bold and the world is full of abundance. You too can rise to be the Superman of Tomorrowland if you just steal a little fire and say a little small furry prayer. That's about all I can do. This side, West of Jesus.
Wow.
I was working it, Steve, and I was
trying. Oh my God. I don't think anybody's ever done that before. That's hysterical. That's pretty funny.
That's what I do. That's my talent. It's my superpower. Yes.
That's excellent. You have a future writing like punk rock Hallmark cards if you want it.
That's why we have the organic nature of our show. That's how we get the good stuff.